Shalom, and welcome to the Israel Policy Pod. I'm Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv and a policy advisor to Israel Policy Forum. I hope everyone listening had a nice and long and appetizing Thanksgiving holiday weekend. Back to business on the Israel Policy Pod. In today's episode, I'll be speaking with Professor Suzy Navot, the Vice President for Research at the Israel Democracy Institute, on the hugely consequential issue of the Israeli judicial system and the planned quote-unquote reforms being threatened by the incoming Netanyahu government. Professor Navot is a legal scholar and expert on constitutional law and has in the past taught at the Strix Faculty of Law, the National Security College, and the Sorbonne in Paris. I can't stress this enough. If there's one episode of the Israel Policy Pod you need to listen to, this is it. But first, a few quick thoughts from me. I can assure all of you not to worry. There will be a new government in Israel in the next few weeks. It will be headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, and it will be the most far right in Israeli history. The coalition horse trading going on right now is par for the course for post-election periods in Israel, with the caveat that Netanyahu's partners on the right know he has no real options other than them. So they're trying to use that leverage to extract ministries and policies from him. So far, I'd argue pretty successfully. Netanyahu has, in fairness, until Christmas Eve to form a government, so there's still plenty of time. But we're already getting a glimpse into what life will be like under this new government. My conversation with Professor Navot focused on the judicial legal plans that are likely afoot. There's also the issue of synagogue and state and the question of Israel's relationship with world Jewry. And there is, of course, the security dimension, and especially as it relates to the West Bank. Over the last week or so, the biggest issue in Israel has been the attack, there's no other word for it, on the IDF by right-wing politicians, especially incoming National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Some of you may be aware of the incident that took place in Hebron last Friday, where one IDF soldier physically assaulted a left-wing activist, while another IDF soldier was filmed saying that, and I quote, Ben-Gvir is going to make order in this entire place. The IDF took action, sentencing the second soldier to 10 days in military prison and making clear to all the soldiers that political statements were outside the bounds, as were politicians themselves meddling in the military chain of command. Ben-Gvir, for his part, doesn't seem to really care. He personally met with the soldier's family and called the prison time a red line and insisted that the IDF top brass isn't and wasn't supportive enough of the troops. This would be bad enough for any future cabinet minister, let alone one that was just given overwhelming power by Netanyahu over Israel's entire police force, including the border police forces operating in the West Bank, including in places like Hebron. The lines of battle are becoming, I'd argue, pretty clear. It's not just the Israeli Supreme Court or the state prosecutors or left-wing NGOs or even the Palestinian Authority that are now in the crosshairs of the incoming government. It's also, apparently, the IDF too. Let's get to Professor Suzy Navot. Hi, Professor Navot. Welcome to Israel Policy Pod.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's our pleasure to have you and for you taking the time to come on to discuss an issue that I think is extremely relevant right now, extremely important for Israel's future, and I think also extremely misunderstood or even not understood at all, which is basically the interplay between the Israeli political and legal slash judicial system. So, Professor, with your permission, I wanted to start there. If you could give us a broad overview, explainer about the Israeli system, right? So we have the legislative branch, obviously the Knesset, we have the executive branch, the government, but what about the judicial legal branch, the Supreme Court, the Attorney General? How do these various branches interplay in the Israeli system?
Well, let me start, if you allow me, and as you're asking me for something that is broad, let me start with something that is going on around the world. And as it has an impact also in Israel. We are witnessing a rise of populism in recent years in several countries. We are even witnessing what I would call a democratic erosion. democracies no longer die in one day. You do not see violent coups that overthrow a government. You see a democracy wearing out, you know, slowly, and sometimes out of sight. You see slow changes that, when you look at each and every one of them separately, they may seem harmless. But it's, you know, the quantity that makes a change, a real change. And in Israel, the constitutional structure of Israel exposes it to the dangers of democratic erosion much more than in any other democratic country. Because in every country, you have tools, you have a system that decentralizes political power. You have checks and balances. You have, first of all, a rigid constitution. Israel does not have it. You have, for example, in the United States, you have the splitting of the legislative authority into two houses. You have the right of veto given to a president on legislation. Many countries have a federal structure or a regional electoral system, or sometimes even the existence of international courts, like the European Court of Human Rights. And all of these are tools that form part of what we call checks and balances. But in Israel, none of them exist. We do not have a stable constitutional structure. Okay. It means that in Israel, the constitution is non-existent. We have, you know that Israel has no one document called the constitution. And for nearly half a century, we were based on the principle of parliamentary sovereignty, meaning the Knesset is a sovereign. Okay, but actually we have human rights and we have basic laws. But these basic laws, although they have constitutional status, they are very easy to amend. And all of these, the lack of checks and balances and the easiness, the unbearable lightness in which you can amend our basic law, means that the politicians in Israel, they have the possibility to change the constitutional rules of the game, the power of the courts, or even the system of government at any time by a simple majority of the Knesset. And this is very important to understand the programs and the ideas and the reforms that we are seeing each and every day now. Because any ordinary majority of the Knesset can delete any basic law or any law in a normal lawmaking procedure in three readings and even within one day. So if the Knesset compromises, the Knesset has 120 members, 61 is a majority. And this is all you need to change Israel completely. 61 in Israel, it means absolute power. And the only branch that may limit the power of government and the power of the Knesset is the Supreme Court. So if you have plans now that are aimed at weakening the Supreme Court or weakening judicial review, it means that the plans are there to limit the tools that we have, the only tool that we have for control or oversight of government. And this is the basic problem. The unbearable lightness in which here, okay, a member of the Knesset may say, okay, I want to change the way of appointing judges, or I want to make or to enact an override clause. And yes, okay, like you say, yes, we can. Okay, yes, they can. 64 is a new government coalition. It will be, I think, in the next days, and all they need is 61.
Right, and so they have the ability to do it, exactly. Like you said, the unbearable lightness of the Israeli system, and really nothing between Jerusalem and the moon, right? No higher body in the Knesset, no, say, Senate, no president with veto power, like you said.
And no constitution, a rigid constitution that is very, very difficult to amend.
Right. Famously, no constitution in Israel. So that's a good setup for what this new incoming government may actually do. They call it judicial reforms. I think that's a very soft euphemism for what they're planning. You could call it a revolution. maybe even the destruction of the Israeli judicial system. So let's go one by one and start off with what you mentioned, the biggest maybe ticket item that they're planning, and maybe as soon as in the matter of days or in the coming weeks, an override clause to Supreme Court decisions by perhaps a simple 61-seat majority in the Knesset. Basically, the Supreme Court in the past, like you said, could strike down a given piece of legislation, deeming it illegal or quote-unquote unconstitutional. But then under the override clause, it could go back to the Knesset, and the Knesset can quote-unquote override the Supreme Court's decision. Explain to us, Professor, first of all, did I get that correct? And secondly...
Perfect. It's perfect. Okay. You don't need any explanation. All I say is I concur. It's perfect.
I appreciate that. So basically, give us an explanation. Why is it such a big deal? Could this really erode the delicate divisions of power that have existed between the various branches? And like you alluded to, any check over government decisions or the Knesset majority?
You know, since the 1990s, with the enactment of two basic laws dealing with human rights and of following a judicial decision of really monumental significance in 1995, Israel may be considered, and I say it, carefully, a constitutional democracy, because we have supreme norms in the basic laws, and following this basic laws, the powers of the legislature nowadays are limited, and laws, as you said, are subject to judicial review. Following, of course, Mavery versus Madison, the American landmark case. Now, although the basic laws have constitutional status, they are, as I told you before, they are very easy to amend. And we have human rights in these basic laws. And, of course, they are not absolute. The Knesset may infringe upon them according to the needs of the state or according to the rights of others. But in order to limit the rights, the rules are very clear and are established in the basic laws themselves. Okay, the basic law, on human dignity, says that there will be no infringement of rights except by a law that is enacted for a proper purpose and to an extent no greater than is required. I mean, that the law needs to be proportionate. So what happens is if the Knesset wants to enact a law that actually limits or infringes upon a human right, for example, the right of equality, but the infringement is not proportional, it's extreme. In this case, as you well said, the law will be struck down by the Supreme Court, will be declared unconstitutional because the Supreme Court may judicially review it. Although our judicial review in Israel is very careful. And for a period of almost 30 years, only 20 laws, mainly sections, have been declared unconstitutional. But, okay, so the court made judicial review and declared this law unconstitutional. But if an override clause is passed, then this override clause section, will allow the Knesset to reenact the law if the majority wants it. It will allow the Knesset to override our human rights, the citizens, the people of Israel. It's not overriding the Supreme Court. It's overriding human rights. And for me, it's difficult actually to exaggerate the danger and the damage of this proposal, because democracy is not only the rule of the majority. Democracy is also an effective protection of human rights, especially the rights of minorities. And, you know, each and every one of us must see each other as a minority sometime. So the override clause would dismantle, I think, the only check that we currently have on the power of the legislature. Okay, it will mean that the protection of human rights will depend entirely on the mercy of the majority.
And let's take it from the theoretical to the tachlis, as I say here. So it's very likely the new government, the incoming government, will actually pass an override clause to the Supreme Court's power of judicial review. So, for instance, let's say the Knesset a week later passes a law saying, you know, various left-wing NGOs are illegal. They're outside the law. In the past, right, these NGOs would have appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court may have perhaps struck down that law, right? So now, presumably, with the override clause, it could just go back to the Knesset and they could still pass the outlawing or banning of those NGOs.
Exactly.
Okay.
And exactly. The only word that I have to say is it's a very good example. And it's only one of many possible, you know, scenarios, but it's there. Majority rules. That's the idea. And there is nothing, only the Supreme Court, to limit this power. And that is the danger. Even if you do not use it, even if the Knesset will not pass this law that infringes human rights in a very, very extreme way, the tool is there. Okay. It is just something that is has a chilling effect on the Supreme Court. There are some people saying, okay, if you pass the override, then it will be much easier for the Supreme Court to judicial review laws because they don't care anymore. They can pass a law and they can decide to declare it unconstitutional. And the Knesset, if it wants it, the Knesset will have to deal with the public consequences. But I do not believe in this scenario. Actually, I think an override clause is a very dangerous tool. It's not used only in Canada, and it's the only country that actually has it. Because if you declare that you have human rights, then what is the need for an override? Override clause means that actually the human rights are not existent if you may limit upon them whenever you want and for whatever reason you want. And that's the problem.
And on the whim of the majority. So they can say not like...
The will of the majority.
And other legal analysts and scholars say the Canadian example isn't quite accurate for Israel's reality for various reasons we don't have to get into. But yes, Canada, I suppose, is the only other country in the world where a parliament or legislature can actually override.
Yes, but we are not Canada.
Yeah.
We are not Canada. And let me tell you that Israel has this idea that it likes some time to copy several arrangements in several countries of the world and bring them to Israel, disregarding what the culture and the whole system. We have the Canadian model of the override, and we want to take the Scandinavian use of the Norwegian law that allows members of the Knesset that becomes minister to resign and etc. And we bring the Bahrain idea of a 2 years budget, and we want now to enact the French law to give immunity to
sitting prime minister. Yes.
And you know, you can smile, and I think it's a sad smile for me, that because I think Israel is a very strong country and we have a very strong democratic spirit, but still the idea of let's bring what is going on nowadays in other countries, for example, they want to bring also the idea of selecting judges that is used in the USA, and I said, okay, but we do not have the American Constitution and the human rights there, etc., etc., and the model and the presidential system, etc., and that is a problem. Okay, talking about Canada as Israel, as if Israel was really, I think, similar to Canada. We are not,
Professor. Why has the override clause been such a big deal for the Israeli right for my opinion, you know, for the better part of the past decade? If, like you said, only, 20, 22 times in the past, the Supreme Court has actually only struck down a law coming out of the Knesset. So why has this become such a big ideological issue, especially for the incoming government?
I think I am not sure that I am the one to answer this question. I think you should ask them. It's a political issue, and I'm not a political person. Of course, I am a jurist, and I specialize in constitutional law. I really don't think they need it. But let me tell you something. I am not against an override. I think that if a compromise is reached, and if actually you have a whole constitution, and if the Knesset decides to finish the unfinished constitution on the 75 years of Israel's independence. And within this constitution, where you entrench all the institutions in it, meaning that you will not be able to make the president disappear. And of course, I'm smiling by a regular law passed by a majority of 2-1, like you may today. And if you entrench, meaning that you say that in order to amend the basic laws on institutions, you will need a special majority of 80 out of 120, then perhaps an override clause will be a temporary right tool for Israel to say the Knesset, okay, we are passing, we are in a transitional period between to a constitutional state, a strong constitutional state. Then you may need it for a period of 4 or 5 years, or by a majority of 80, let's say, if you need a law, a specific law that is inconsistent with the constitution. It's something that you may think about it, but not here, not there, and not by using the power of the majority. There is not consensus about it. The polls nowadays say that the majority of the people are against an override. Not only the majority of the people that have voted for this government, but a majority, a whole majority, I think 60 and plus than 60, they're against it. So it's not the way to do it. But I am not against the idea of an override. But I don't know the reason why they want it now. The only reason I can think about it is because they have some laws that they want to pass that they know that these are unconstitutional laws.
Right. And perhaps maybe as soon as next week or the following week, maybe one of those laws may be trying to make kosher the appointment of Aryeh Deri, the head of the ultra-Orthodox Shas party, to be minister in the next government. Deri obviously was famously found guilty of bribery in the late 90s and spent time in jail. And then earlier this year pled guilty to tax evasion and ostensibly cannot serve again as a minister for the coming years, but they may want to change that law. And
yes, and this is not a law, you know, this is a basic law. This is something like you want to change the American Constitution. Just imagine that you need to change the American Constitution in order to do something.
For one person.
Yeah, for one person. So in Israel, it's very easy to do, and they indeed, It's a change in the basic law on the government, and all they need for this change, which is actually a very small change, is 61. And let me remind you that the last, I don't know, when I said the last government, I go up back 4 years, but it's not exactly the last government. But you know, the government that was a two-headed government with two prime ministers, I don't know any other place in the world where this existed. Netanyahu and Gantz,
right,
when they formed the government, a two-headed government, yeah, they needed also to change this basic law on the government, because our basic law only knows of a government headed by one prime minister. So before even the government was sworn, they changed the law. And this is exactly what they intend to do with the basic law on the government, according or dealing with Aryeh Deri. Exactly.
But then to take this to maybe its logical conclusion, they changed that law and then its appeal to the Supreme Court, will the government actually need to enact an override clause just in case the Supreme Court actually decides to strike down this amendment that would allow Deri to be a minister?
No, it's a very good question, Ari, but it's a basic law. And actually, the Israeli Supreme Court has never really interfered in a basic law. Okay, it is what we would call in the world an unconstitutional constitutional amendment. And this is something very, I think it's like a non-conventional weapon. The court may do that, but in my opinion, they will not use this non-conventional weapon of striking down an amendment to the constitution because of the case of Deri. But if they completely change the judiciary, okay, in order that they change the independence of the judiciary and they pass an override clause that is a very wide override clause, that a section that will say that not only a ruling of the High Court that declares unconstitutional a law, but any ruling of the High Court in Israel or the Supreme Court maybe declared void by a law, then perhaps it will cause the court to say this is an unconstitutional constitutional amendment. But I don't see the case of Derry
rising to that level,
actually causing the Supreme Court.
Very interesting. So they may want to keep their powder dry for a future battle. And just allow Derry exactly. to be appointed. Final question, Professor, on the issue of the override clause. We talked about Knesset legislation going to the Supreme Court and then maybe back to the Knesset. Would the override clause also encompass government decisions that in the past have been appealed and struck down by the Supreme Court?
This is a very good question. And unfortunately, I do not have the answer. I will have the answer as soon as I see it, because when you talk about an override clause, there are many ways of enacting or of writing down or passing an override clause. You may pass it within the basic law of human rights. You may pass it within the basic law on the judiciary, and it's the wording that makes the mm-hmm. sense of it. It may be a small override dealing only with laws, saying, for example, that the Knesset may pass a law after a decision in the Supreme Court striking down a law. But it may also be different, like you just mentioned. It may be a very, very wide override, saying that any decision by the Supreme Court dealing with decisions of government may be also overrided by the Knesset, which is something completely different. And the meaning is completely different. So we'll have to wait and see which kind of override clause are they speaking about.
That's a good point. We have to wait and see how far the incoming government actually wants to take this. But first, we'll be right back after this brief message.
Israel Policy Forum works to strengthen support for advancing a viable two-state outcome to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to preserve Israel's future as Jewish, democratic, and secure. We provide constructive policy analysis and pragmatic policy recommendations, produce credible research reports, deliver thoughtful and nuanced commentary, build engaging and innovative educational content, and create informational video content covering critical issues. We are trusted as a reliable resource in Washington and the Jewish community. To explore more of our work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, U.S.-Israel relations, Israeli politics, Israeli-Arab regional integration, and the future of the two-state solution, read the Koplow column, Chief Policy Officer Michael Koplow's weekly article on current events, engage with our young professional network, IPF Atid, or join one of our live video briefings featuring top journalists from the region. If you rely on Israel Policy Forum for credible informational and thoughtful analysis, please make a gift today to ensure that Israel Policy Forum's work continues to have an impact. Donate now at israelpolicyforum.org/support.
Professor, you alluded to the government perhaps also changing the way Supreme Court justices are appointed. Historically and by tradition here in Israel, it's done by committee. You have judges and lawyers and also politicians coming together and kind of deciding by consensus who gets appointed to the courts. Correct me if I'm wrong, but they're also planning on reforming that and having it be completely beholden to the politicians.
Exactly. They want to introduce, political factors in the committee to change the balance between the political and the professional, which is actually, for me, I think it's even more dangerous than the override in many ways, because it's the importance of the balance in this committee between the professional considerations and the political considerations, which actually preserves the independence of the judges in Israel. And it's especially important because of the background that I gave you. The judiciary, the independent judiciary, is the only factor restraining the power of government. We do not have two houses. We do not have president. We do not have decentralization of power. So we do not have a guarantee of the independent status of the judges. For example, their tenure. They may be removed by a simple law tomorrow, removed of their office. We do not have any guarantee of the date of the retirement. We do not have any guarantees. I mean, constitutional guarantees on the method of appointment and removal. They are, although in a basic law, but this basic law on the judiciary can be changed by a simple majority. There is no even necessary to gain a majority of 61. By 2-1, you can do that. And this is a problem because in Israel, the Supreme Court is not only the Supreme Court of Justice dealing with, you know, the constitutional issues. The constitutional issues are less than 10% of the cases. In Israel, the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court of Appeals in civil cases and in criminal cases. So you really need judges that think and understand professional legal standards. Okay, you will not imagine that you introduce political considerations into cases, appointing judges that are only political appointments, that they have to rule on appeals on the guilt of persons in serious crimes, on civil claims, claims on real estate matters, on family law. And it may lead to decisions that are completely irrelevant and even wrong from a legal professional point of view. We do not have a specific court and constitutional court. Perhaps we should have. If a constitution if we reach a constitution, I think on the 75 year after the establishment of the state, if we have a constitution, but perhaps we will have a constitutional court. But nowadays, I cannot even think about the legal, you know, repercussions that it may have, because we need professional judges in these cases.
I was going to just add that, hypothetically speaking, of course, the Supreme Court, as the court of last appeals, could also hear the appeal of, say, a hypothetical prime minister who's hypothetically on trial, and his case may go to appeal to that court.
Exactly.
And so this is political considerations.
This is something interesting that you mentioned, because you know that the religious Zionist plan and the religious Zionism is one of the components of the coalition. They presented a plan, a judicial plan. It's called Law and Justice. I think like the name of the ruling party in Poland. And this plan is actually they propose to reboot, to restart Israel's constitutional law. And one of the things that they want to change is everything that has to do with the case of Netanyahu. I think one part of this plan, which is a very serious plan and very detailed plan on what to do with the judiciary, they want, for example, to erase the crime of fraud and breach of trust. That is one, the main crime for which the prime minister, the next prime minister Netanyahu, has been indicted for. They want to enact, or they plan to enact, what is called here a French law, which will not allow to investigate or to indict the prime minister and the ministers during their mandate. And they want also to expand the parliamentary immunity and to prohibit the court from dealing with any Knesset decisions regarding parliamentary immunity. So if you look at all these proposed reforms all together, is like, you know, it's like legalization of corruption, because they want to delete the crime of breach of trust. This is a basic tool in our fight against corruption. Okay, it means that public figures are not allowed to pursue personal benefits from the office. That if you have governing power, it's for the good and the welfare of the public and not for your or his or her own benefit. And if you delete an offense in Israel, it means that if an offense is removed from the criminal code, that all cases pending in which persons are accused of this offense will be stopped. And you can imagine that this is not something that is theoretically. They are speaking about the case of Netanyahu.
So that could actually just get the case thrown out completely if they just throw out the actual charges. Exactly. in the legal book.
Exactly.
And I mean, I guess we should get into it right now, the issue of Netanyahu's ongoing corruption trial. So you laid out a few scenarios that could stop the trial or suspend the trial. And we should also mention, right, that they passed these laws, and I guess traditionally it would be appealed to the Supreme Court. But if you already pass an override clause to Supreme Court decisions, then you could still push those laws through.
Exactly. And if you pass this law in the beginning by a majority of 61, then it's like you use the override before you even go to the court. They will not need it to pass it again by a majority of 61. Exactly like you said.
I see. Okay, so you laid out various scenarios that Netanyahu can get out of the corruption trial. One other scenario that I heard from other legal analysts was effectively having the attorney general, any, I guess, future or new attorney general, suspend proceedings. So, Professor, could you get into the role of the attorney general in the Israeli system? I think it's fairly unique, right, even on a global level.
Indeed, he is. He represents the public good. He actually is the attorney for the government. He is the legal counselor of government, and he is actually the one who makes the interpretation of the law for the government, meaning that he says when the decisions by government are outside the law or within the law, meaning if they are constitutional or unconstitutional. And therefore, it's a very powerful person in Israel. It will not be easy to let him, now it's a her, to let her, Gali Barav Miara is her name, to let her out of office, to dismiss her. It's a procedure, and it will be, it's a long procedure. And the procedure itself may come to before the Supreme Court. But yes, a future attorney general may, of course, suspend the proceedings. But I'm not sure that Netanyahu is going for it. I really do not know. This is one part of the plan that presented by the Zionist religious
Zionism.
One part of the plan deals also with the attorney general, because it's also, you know, it's a tool also for control and oversight of government as well, because she may say today that this decision by government is not according to the law, and therefore it will be very difficult to defend the decision if an appeal to a petition to the Supreme Court is passed, and she is the one that represents the government in court. Let me tell you something about it. You know, until now, the attorney general was an independent and professional and objective person, and what I see when I look and when I read the plan, the law and justice plan, is they actually propose to change. And to change the idea that there are things in the country that are really professional, objective, and independent. For example, the public system. For example, the public service. For example, the attorney general or the chief of staff or the police commissioner or the judges. What they want,
the legal advisors to the ministries.
Exactly. They want control over the appointment of everybody, meaning that they want to politicize the public system. It may be familiar to you, to a presidential system, but still you have checks and balances. And we do not have. So this plan to delete everything that is independent, professional, and objective, and to allow everything to become the government's, it essentially cancels the separation of power. It concentrates all power in the hands of government. It's a politicization of judicial system and of the gatekeepers. So you weaken the public legal attorneys. You damage the independence of the judiciary, and in a way that it will not allow any effective control over illegal conduct of government. And it may happen. It may happen that the conduct of decisions of government are illegal. So you will not have anybody, you know, to raise the flag saying it's a black flag. You cannot do that. And that is the main problem. I think the overall view, reform on this or on that, when you look at all it together, it's the quantity that makes the quality, like we say in Israel.
Yes, it would be, I guess, one thing if it was this reform or that reform, but taken together, and especially, I think, in the current political context.
Yes, exactly. Because if you speak about an override, only an override, we may speak about, we may conduct discussions about it, and I think in a certain way it may be done. And if you talk about splitting the attorney general that will not be also the head of the prosecution in Israel, I think it's a good idea, and we should do that. Okay, but we are not talking about this kind of reforms. We're talking about an overall reform of everything together.
Yeah, like we said, it's not so much reform, but a revolution and, wholesale destruction of the system as we've come to know it over the past few decades. Professor, just to clarify for our listeners, the best way I can explain the Attorney General role here, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, is that basically the Attorney General in Israel is the head of the prosecution, the highest legal authority in the land, but also the lead legal advisor to the government. So basically a combination in the American context of the Attorney General and a White House counsel is the way I've been explained.
I agree with you. It's a very accurate way of putting it. And I will add something else that they represent me as well, meaning that she has the power to interfere in every case that has been heard now in the district court, for example. If the case has public importance, so he represents or she represents the public interest in every case, and she may say, "Okay, I want to get into this case of." Joe versus Doe, and I want to put an opinion because in my view, this has implications for the future of this problem in Israel. They may do that. So it's a very, very important task as well in addition to all that you have already put forward before.
And just to tie up the issue of Netanyahu's corruption trial, as from a purely legal point of view, what do you think is the most likely scenario that the incoming government takes to, say, extricate Netanyahu from the trial or suspend the trial? Do you think it's something like a French law? Do you think it's something like just throwing out charges of fraud and breach of trust from the legal book? What do you think we'll actually be looking at?
First of all, let me tell you, I'm an Israeli, but I'm not a prophet. So I do not know what is going to happen. Let me tell you something that is really a problem within this case. You know, we speak and we've been speaking about the problems of the legal system, but the real problem of the legal system, nobody's talking about. And it's the time that takes for criminal proceedings in Israel. We have been hearing cases for 5, 6, or 7 years in court. Now, the investigation against Netanyahu started in 2017. The indictment was filed in January 2020, and we are, the last day of November 2022, almost 3 years since the indictment was filed, and we are hearing, I think, the beginning of the witnesses, the 20s or 25 witnesses out of almost 300, which means that we are still at the beginning of the presentation of evidence in the district court, and of course, this case will be appealed, as you said before, by both sides before the Supreme Court. So this is a real problem. If Netanyahu's case, if it continues, it could last at least another 3 or 4 years. Now, what kind of justice is it? If you have a citizen that has a cloud above his head, a dark cloud of a criminal indictment, and has to wait for 5, 6, or 7 years, and then perhaps... or go to jail or declare innocent. This is a problem, a real problem. And we are not dealing with it. We're not dealing with the procedures in criminal cases. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I do not know what will happen to Netanyahu's case. Perhaps a plea bargain, or the, you know, the crime of breach of trust will be cancelled. There are many possibilities, or perhaps the French law will be passed, and they will say, okay, for the next 4 years, Netanyahu is the prime minister, and the case will stop, and we will continue it only after he's out of office. I mean, perhaps in another 8 years, what will happen to the witnesses then? We do not know, but it's also a possibility.
8 years or never, in terms of Netanyahu in office. Professor, last two issues I wanted to raise. Number one, I guess, very basically, you know, if the Israeli public and the Israeli gatekeepers, like you said, in the judicial system is looking on at all this, and even, you know, people all over the world that care about Israel and care about what happens in Israel, what tools or methods do the opponents of these quote unquote reforms have to stop them? Is there anything that actually can be done to forestall what may be coming down the pike?
I think all methods and all tools have to be within the law. Okay, this is an elected government, and it's a democratic elected government, and this is very important to remember. The first tool that I think that the opposers have is the Supreme Court, if it's still there. If, you know, the amendments to the Israeli constitution, to the Israeli basic laws are very, very problematic, then the Supreme Court may use this unconventional weapon that we've been speaking about of declaring some of these amendments that they are opposed to the basic principles of the Israeli system. Israel has a declaration of independence. Israel has the basic statement that it is a Jewish and democratic country. It is not only Jewish, and it is not only a democracy. It is both, and there should be a balance between both of them. So if the government, using the Knesset, wants to destroy or to really harm one of these two principles, the Supreme Court is still there. And this is something that we will have, it remains to be seen, and I myself hope it will never be used, this tool. And the court says, we hope we will never have to say that this is an amendment that harms the basic structure of the state of Israel. Because the elected government that rules by a majority, I think they do not have the power to change the basic system of Israel. Meaning that they cannot declare that Israel will not be Jewish anymore, and they cannot declare that Israel is not a democracy anymore.
So you're referring basically to the Supreme Court actually coming out and saying that an amendment by the Knesset to a basic law is just fundamentally unconstitutional.
Exactly.
Okay. And further steps that you could foresee? I mean, are we looking at maybe, you know, if things are taken to their most extreme, resignations of Supreme Court justices, resignations of attorney generals, things of that nature?
Well, you know, Larry, this is not an optimistic talk anyway. So I think...
Well, this is Israel Policy Pod, so yes, we have we have to maintain a certain level of expectation here.
Yes, of course. I really don't know. And I do not want to speak about this, you know, extreme measures or extreme tools to be used in any case. The government has not been, you know, sworn in yet. We do not have the bills that have been put on the table. I think I will be much more intelligent in a few weeks. And I will say, I think Netanyahu understands. I think he's a very wise person, even though he is indicted and it has changed many of the ways that he sees democracy. But still, I think he understands you know, the dangers to a democratic state, not only, you know, the dangers to the legal system, but dangers also for the international community, for the Jewish diaspora, and the economic dangers of becoming something that is not exactly a democratic country, like we're seeing now in Poland and Poland and in Hungary. And I think he understands. So I think for this question, which is an important question, and for me something that is, I'm thinking about it a lot, I think that the answers, I would prefer to leave it, I think, for the future, and perhaps we will not even need them for the future.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, yes, indeed.
And final question, Professor, and that's a good transition to what you just alluded to, is Israel's international standing. So even Netanyahu, say a decade ago, was talking about stopping all these types of reforms to the Israeli judicial system because of the damage it could do to Israel's international legal standing, i.e. that it would open up Israel to certain claims by, say, the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, that Israel's legal system wasn't independent or strong enough to actually be deemed credible. And in recent weeks, we've also heard analysts here in Israel talk more and more about these wholesale reforms that are being planned as potentially opening up Israel to international legal liabilities. So explain to us basically what that could mean, you know, whether this is actually a real threat, you know, for instance, having Israeli military officers be put on trial on the ICC or certain Israeli politicians being sued in international courts.
Well, I think that everything that you have explained is very accurate. You know, Israel's legal system and the independence of the legal system has been forever, I think, the Iron Dome of Israel. President Barak standing in international in the international arena, the legal arena, was always very, very strong. And his cases, which it's very interesting because, you know, the cases dealing with international problems, like the dealing with terrorism and the measures that we use against terrorism that are always, you know, seen by the international arena as something very problematic. We have this protection by the Supreme Court. The cases were always explained and they were always published in English. It means that the cases were given for the audience that is outside the country. And therefore, our soldiers and our officers have always been protected by the Supreme Court. But if you change all that, if you change the Supreme Court, if you change the way of appointment judges, and they will not be independent, they will be politicized, what kind of protections are we giving to what we're doing within the country and in the occupied territories or in Judea and Samaria? What will happen? And this is something that has to be taken into consideration when they are thinking about changing these laws, because it's very important. Until now, everything that Israel has done, we have had this security among us that nothing will happen to our officials and to our soldiers when they, you know, travel around the world. But if you change it, then this Iron Dome will not exist anymore. And you know that the main thing Barak said is that we actually, as a democracy, we fight with one hand tied up behind our back, because there are things that we cannot do. And this was the opening of every case dealing with the fight against terrorism. And it's in if you open, for example, the internet site of the Supreme Court, you will see in English, not every case that is rendered in Israel has been translated, but everything that has to do with the territories and with human rights in the territories and with the fighting against terrorism is in English for the audience outside Israel. But what will happen now? The question you have put it, you have put the question forward, and the answer that I have for you is that we do not know. If they change the rules of the game, the way of appointing judges, if they do not allow for laws to be judicially reviewed, then it will have, it will affect the international community vis-a-vis Israel and the international courts vis-a-vis Israel.
Okay. Professor Navot, by the way, Barak is Aharon Barak, the former and legendary Chief Justice and President of the Supreme Court.
And you know, if we're talking about it, I think it's important to finish with one of his, I think his sentences that it's very important nowadays. He wrote and he said that if you do not defend democracy, it will not protect and defend you. And this is something very important nowadays for our audience, for us Israelis. We have to defend our democracy. It's a weak constitutional frame, but it's a strong spirit of democracy. And I hope we will be able to stand for it.
Amen. I hope you're right, Professor Navot. Thank you so much for taking the time and explaining all of these very important issues to our listeners. And like you said, it remains to be seen what the incoming government has in store. But this will assuredly be one of the major areas that we need to keep looking at. So thank you.
My pleasure was mine. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks again to Professor Susie Navot for her generous time and insights. Also, special thanks to our producer, Jacob Gilman, and to all of you who support Israel Policy Forum's work, including this podcast. You know who you are. Just remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, thank you for listening.